Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There are two separate calls for an investigation surrounding a Sacramento City Council member whose residency is being called into question. This follows an exclusive in the Sacramento Bee reporting that Council Member Sean Lalowey did not live in the district he serves, a legal requirement, but in a million-dollar home in Granite Bay in neighboring Placer County. Lalowey's district is home to some of the most underserved neighborhoods in the city of Sacramento. We've made multiple attempts to reach out to Councilmember Lalowey, including for today's segment, and he has not replied. Aside from an email statement following the initial SACB article about 2 weeks ago denying the report and that the city has verified his residency. So with that, CAP Radio News Editor Chris Hooks joins us with the latest developments. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Vicky.
All right, Chris, let's start off with getting people just up to speed on why we're talking about Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowey.
So he's being accused of not living in city council district he was elected to represent in 2020. There have been rumors and speculation since around the time that he was sworn in that he didn't live in the district during his swearing in ceremony, which was done over Zoom because of the pandemic. He was standing in this really massive living room space with a nice fireplace behind him, really grand ceilings that you could see when he stood up to take the oath of office. So not at all what you think of when you think of the homes in District 2. So a couple of weeks ago, Teresa Cliff with the Sacramento Bee, who you had on Insight last week, published a story that laid out those facts, but also some pretty damning information. She spoke to the person who lives in the home that Lalowey claims to live in, where he's also registered to vote. And that person said Lalowey does not live there. And Lalowey has refuted those claims since.
For those who don't live in the city of Sacramento, describe District 2, which Councilmember Lalowey represents.
District 2 encompasses neighborhoods like North Sacramento, El Paso Heights, Hagenwood, Robla, Woodlake. It's very diverse, lots of tight-knit communities. There are a lot of older homes, not much new development, though that's not for lack of trying, but also has lots of a lot of the folks in the district struggle financially. It's also been historically one of the more underserved districts and overlooked in terms of neighborhoods.
Well, now this week, there are new developments, two separate calls for investigations into Councilmember Lalowey's residency. Let's start with the first one, which involves the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg.
Right. So Mayor Steinberg sent a letter to Lalowey on Tuesday afternoon. It essentially gave the council member two options: agree to an independent investigation or have city council vote for the independent investigation. Steinberg wrote, and I'm quoting here, your agreement would allow me to avoid asking the city council formally to initiate the same process. I am prepared to do so this week if necessary. I hope it's not necessary. Lalowey chose the latter. With the council on break until mid-July, they'll have to schedule a special meeting at some point for the vote. As of this morning, and I just refreshed the page just before I jumped on, that meeting date or time has not been posted.
Okay, so there's still some unknowns. There's also a separate request for an independent investigation. Who are the people behind this one?
So this is a group of District 2 community members, which obviously is Lalowey's district. The group consists of more than a dozen people, including the district's active transportation commissioner, which is someone who is appointed by the district council member, the executive director of the Del Paso Boulevard Partnership, and leaders from multiple community neighborhood associations. I spoke with one of the people who signed the letter. His name's Zach Trowbridge. He's a member of the Hagenwood Community Association.
I'd love for this process to be very civil and for no one to be torn down over it. But we need the truth, right? The residents of District 2 deserve the truth, and residents of the entire city deserve the truth, because as we all know, one city council member affects more than just their district. Their vote impacts the entire city. So if it comes out that it's true that this person doesn't even live in the city or the county, you know, that could potentially hurt the entire city.
And I should note that Hagenwood is the neighborhood that Lalowe says he lives in.
Yeah, Chris, I want to clarify something. When you were talking about the active transportation commissioner, they're appointed by the council member. Would that be, did Councilmember Lalowe appoint this transportation commissioner that took part in the second separate call for an independent investigation?
I'm not sure if it was from Lalowe's appointee or if it was his predecessor, Alan Warren's.
Right, because he's been a council member for about 2 years, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So both you and myself have tried multiple times over the course of nearly 2 weeks to speak to Councilmember Lalowe. Did he ever respond to you? I mean, he declined or postponed an interview he initially agreed to about 2 weeks ago, and then he's been silent ever since for us.
Yeah, I've texted him a few times, left voice messages a number of times, sent multiple emails. He actually left me on red last week when I texted to ask about the photos of the Granite Bay home that I found on the internet. The photos matched the living room where he was sworn in, a place that he admittedly lied to when he told the Sacramento Bee that it was his friend's home in East Sacramento. And I say admittedly because he actually acknowledged it in the statement that the council member's office sent out to the mayor after Steinberg's request. He said he lied to essentially, and I'm quoting here, ensure the safety and privacy of his family.
Did he elaborate on what the safety and privacy of his family, what the concern was?
Not in the letter, but in an interview with CBS 13 last week, he mentioned that his wife had racist threatening messages sent to her, and presumably it's that. But he didn't elaborate in the message to Steinberg.
Yeah, and we'll get to CBS 13 in just a moment. I'm just curious, Chris. I mean, when you first read the SACB report nearly 2 weeks ago, and there's been follow-up reporting by Teresa Clift, as a journalist that really focuses heavily on the city of Sacramento, were you surprised?
I can't say that I was. So, like I said earlier, this has been like a rumor and speculation for some time. And quite frankly, his predecessor, Alan Warren, was also accused of not living in the district. Warren represented the district for 8 years. Obviously, that speculation and rumor, no reports had been done about that. So it's tough to say that I'm surprised. Yeah.
Yeah, Lalowe, as you touched upon, did speak with one outlet in response to the Sacramento Bee's reporting, and that's CBS 13. What struck you about the interview?
So there was quite a bit of backtracking from what he initially told the Bee 2 weeks ago. He told the newspaper that he and his family moved to Hagenwood, then Robla for a few months, then back to Hagenwood. He also said the Granite Bay house had been vacant for 2 years. Then he told CBS 13 inside of what is presumed to be that Hagenwood home, though the TV station didn't explicitly say it, that his wife and kids moved to the Granite Bay house in August of last year. So quite a bit of backtracking.
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio news editor Chris Hooks about separate calls for an independent investigation into Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowe's proof of residency in the district he serves. How much does a city council member in Sacramento make? Is that council member Lalowe's sole income?
So council members make just shy of $100,000, which actually is an adjustment that became effective this month. But no, that's not Lalowe's sole source of income. The council member also owns grocery stores, two of which are in his North Sacramento district. I should note that he's also faced multiple lawsuits over the grocery stores that have claimed that he violated labor laws. That includes one by the federal government, which alleges Lalowe threatened to deport employees who cooperated with the federal investigation into his grocery stores. That story was actually broken also by the Sacramento Bee last week.
So there's just a lot of developments. I mean, when it goes to the residency part of all of this, what are the potential consequences if a council member doesn't live in the district they serve?
So specifically for this, I think the biggest consequences for the council member is not being on the council anymore. He could get kicked off or voted off. He's also registered to vote in the house that he's accused of not living in. So if that's proven true that he doesn't live there, he could also face voter fraud. I'd also like to add that the people who suffer the most here are those who live in an already historically underserved District 2.
Right. Some may think, though, you know, what's the big deal? How does this compromise the integrity of an elected position? What's your response to that?
I mean, I think part of that question goes into one's own opinion, obviously, but I certainly think it's fair to point out that many people elect candidates because they believe they share lived experiences since they're neighbors. They vote for candidates who they trust, would represent them and their interests, because as residents of the district, the candidates know the area. So I think in addition to the question of integrity, this also comes down to trust and loss of trust.
Yeah. Going back to Mayor Steinberg's call for an independent investigation, he also indicated that he would schedule a special meeting. I mean, it's almost the end of the week. I know we're going into a holiday week. You mentioned a recess for the city council. Any idea when that could take place?
I just refreshed my email and the city of Sacramento's webpage and still no clue when, but I'll keep refreshing the city council's website and bugging the city clerk for answers.
Yeah, and I'm sure you'll tweet it out too, Chris.
for sure.
Following all of this, this clearly is an evolving investigation and story. What are the next steps that you'll be following?
I think the obvious ones, seeing what unfolds with the special meeting and tracking who votes in favor of it to see who the council member has behind him, and then tracking what happens with the investigation.
Chris, thanks.
Thanks, Vicky.
That is CAP Radio news editor Chris Hooks. Up next, California's adult population is aging. A recent survey of caregivers in the Central Valley is providing a glimpse of the emotional and financial toll. We'll also learn about a program in the works to create affordable options to age at home. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Within the next decade, California's adult population is expected to be much older than it's ever been before. According to the state, one out of every four Californians, that's nearly 11 million people, will be over 60 by 2030, outnumbering those 18 and under for the first time. This growing older population means more responsibility will fall on families and communities for help with meals, medication, transportation, personal care, and other services. A recent survey of over 1,700 caregivers in Stanislaus and Merced counties is giving us a unique glimpse into the lives of those caring for their loved ones and the emotional and financial challenges they face every day. That survey was conducted by the Legacy Health Endowment to better understand the needs of these caregivers and is using this feedback to develop a program that will build the first national database to better understand how much it truly costs to take care of loved ones. Joining us now is Jeffrey Lewis, President and CEO of Legacy Health Endowment Interlock. Jeffrey, good morning. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning. How are you today?
I just think this is an issue that so many people can relate to, myself included. Can you tell us what the Legacy Health Foundation is, how it started, and why this regional survey is so important?
Legacy Health Endowment was created when Emmanuel Medical Center, the local hospital, was sold to Doctors Medical Center in Modesto. So a nonprofit sold to a for-profit. It's known as a asset purchase, and the remaining net proceeds from the sale created Legacy Health Endowment.
How long has it been around?
Been around since 2014. I am the first CEO that started in June 1st, 2016.
Yeah, so it's relatively new, about 8 years, less than a decade old. But addressing the needs of an aging population has been a passion of yours going back to the 1980s. You were working with Senator Robert Packwood of Oregon back then. How has this issue evolved over the last four decades?
You know, long-term care issues have been at the forefront of the needs of the nation for years, but Congress has never figured out how to address them. Typically, it's addressed through the Medicaid program, or in California, Medi-Cal. But what we focused on, and what we focused on 20, 40 years ago, and what we're focused on today, is that forgotten middle, that middle-income population who doesn't qualify for Medicaid unless they spend down and go broke. Medicare doesn't provide any of these kinds of services, and people who are middle income and retire end up spending thousands of dollars out of pocket to qualify for services that others get for free.
Given that you've been the CEO for the Legacy Health Endowment for about 8 years now, and this is in the Central Valley, what's unique about the region and the people that are in the Central Valley that you serve?
You know, what's unique is it's an international melting pot, large Latino population, Portuguese, Swedish, Iranian, Iraqi, now Ukrainian, and Afghanistan. And as these populations age in place, they are looking for a home in terms of caring for an older person or a spouse caring for her husband. The services on the Medi-Cal side exist to some degree. But again, for that forgotten middle, those middle-income retirees out there, there's nothing for them. They have to pay for everything out of pocket.
As California's aging population continues to grow, so too are the number of people becoming caregivers for spouses, loved ones, aging parents. Based on the over 1,700 caregivers in your regional survey of Stanislaus and Merced counties, can you paint a picture to our listeners of who these people are?
Absolutely. Let me give you six data points that should help. 72% of the caregivers in our analysis are people primarily responsible for caregiving and paying the bills. Nearly 8 in 10 say their caregiving responsibilities have had an impact on their ability to pay household expenses. A majority have used savings, borrowed money, or increased credit card debt to help pay for the costs associated with caregiver responsibilities. Almost 50% have lost a job or closed a business because of being a full-time caregiver. Two more important points. 93%, 9 out of 10, say that their caregiving responsibilities have impacted their own overall physical health. And about 75% said that their caregiving responsibilities have impacted their mental or emotional health. So imagine, you know, a spouse, married couple, as they're aging in place, the husband's typically the one who gets sick, that's what happens. She's now caring for him both as a spouse and a caregiver. No one thinks about the impact on her, which is devastating both emotionally, mental health, physically, and financially. So our objective was to say, what is this? What does this really mean? And how do we build a solution to help those families who are caring for an aging spouse or someone like you, Vicky, who could be caring for an aging parent? How do we help them as well so that at the end of the day, they don't have to leave the workplace and find that mom and dad are fully taken care of by services in the home? More importantly, what does it cost to provide those services so that we can build a database to say to state legislators and federal legislators, here's what you can do. Here's the art of the possible. That's what we focus on at Legacy Endowment. What's the art of the possible in terms of doing this and giving people the information to make informed decisions?
Yeah, because it doesn't exist in a vacuum. And as this population grows, both as caregivers and as an aging population, it'll just have ripple effects throughout communities and across the state. Is that what you meant when you were talking about, you know, that hypothetical situation of a wife caring for her spouse, that these caregivers are often thought of or not even thought of as a forgotten middle? You've previously referenced that. Is that what you mean?
The forgotten middle is that middle-income population. They make too much money to qualify for Medi-Cal unless they spend down all their assets to become poor. But they're not wealthy enough to afford to really pay for the services out of their pockets. So what happens is that caregiver is dipping into her retirement nest egg, which may be small or slightly large. It's not going to be enormous. And the more she taps into that retirement nest egg to pay for these services, it jeopardizes her financial health. You know, the poverty in old age has a distinct female face. One of the reasons that contributes that is that that caregiver, typically a woman, leaves the workplace. So imagine the picture is this. She's a 50-some-year-old woman whose spouse becomes disabled and she stays home to take care of him. So A, she's no longer contributing to her 401k. B, she's not working, so she's not getting Social Security credits. C, she's not accumulating any benefits. D, she's finding that all of these things result in a series of zeros. So as she's working with her husband to care for him, no one's caring for her financial future. And in the end, she finds herself a Medicaid recipient or an SSI, and for the first time in her life, she could be poor. After he passes away. That's not what America is about. Our objective is to say, let's care about the middle income. Let's care about families. Let's make sure Vicky Gonzalez, who may be caring for a mom or dad, doesn't have to leave the workplace, but has services that she can tap into without going broke.
When it comes to the survey, how did you locate the respondents for this survey? You know, more than 1,700 people.
You know, we use a pollster, Jay Wallen and Associates, nationally recognized. They do all the work in finding the recipients. They interview them all. We build the polling questions together, and they reach out and find these individuals. In this particular case, we used both traditional polling sources by reaching out by phone, through Facebook and other social media sources to expand the number of people who we could talk to make sure that we had a really full picture of what is going on in the world of caregivers.
Given that this has been a significant focus of yours for decades, was there anything in this survey that surprised you?
No. And I hate to say it that way, but no. The sad part for me is we haven't dealt with it at a state or national level. But most importantly, I think that the even sadder part is if we don't address the caregiver needs, then we are simply building a larger population of poor older women in the future. That's not what our Legacy Health Endowment wants to do. So one of the things that we are doing is building a new plan. We called it person-centered care. We'll launch it in August. It'll be for people in our footprint in Southern Stanislaus County and Northern Merced County, people who have multiple comorbidities like diabetes, asthma, cancer, congestive heart failure, and unable to care for themselves, they will dial a phone number or email. They'll see if they're eligible for this program. And we'll provide a set of services for them for the next 6 to 12 months as we build that database. But the other thing that we're doing is we will talk to the spouse. So where there is a caregiver spouse who is providing most of those services, and we'll come in and provide the services for her. One of the things we're looking at is what's the financial impact on her today and tomorrow? And if we determine that there's been an adverse impact on her financial stability, she will be eligible for up to, or he will be eligible for up to $200 a month for the next 6 months. So, and determine, does that $200 a month stipend help them reduce their impact on their nest egg, their retirement nest egg, for the future? And how does it impact them?
The city of Turlock, when talking about person-centered care, this initiative that you're going to be launching in about a month or so, the city is contributing $200,000 to this initiative. And it is believed to be the first city in California to contribute this type of home care. What does it mean to have this level of support from the city?
You know, it's an incredible opportunity. I met with the mayor, who's spectacular, and the city council members, all who are committed to these kinds of issues, who want to make sure that Turlock stands out tall and proud. And so we will use their dollars specifically for services for people in the city of Turlock. They will range from homemaker services to respite care to in-home physician care. Our program is designed so that if you don't have a doctor, we will send one to you, or you'll talk to him or her by on screen, telehealth. If you don't have food, we will provide that food. So the city of Turlock in the Central Valley, about 70,000 citizens, this microcosm of, you know, what rural America is, will be the poster child for understanding how do we address the long-term care needs of the total population, including the forgotten middle.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Jeffrey Lewis, President and CEO of Legacy Health Endowment, about their survey of caregivers in Stanislaus and Merced counties. When you are talking about this pilot project, a big component of this is remaining at home as opposed to going to an assisted living center. I know for my parents, caring for their parents, my grandparents, the overwhelming desire was to stay at home. But your survey also revealed that that is the case for many people, an overwhelming majority of elderly Californians in need of long-term care prefer to remain at home. Staying at home could be anyone's first choice, but what are some of the biggest obstacles or difficult choices they have to weigh when deciding if that's the right route?
These are the real tough choices in people's lives. The first thing that that a family needs to do is talk to the patient, include the patient in the decision-making process so that they're not forgotten. They have to look at these issues economically. What's financially feasible in terms of today and tomorrow? What's the impact going to be on us? So Vicki, use your parents. What's the impact going to be on your parents as they're caring for their parents?
Yeah, who work full time, like many people, you're juggling a lot.
Right. And then look at the issues of how do we find services and what happens to that married couple. So one of the things we talked about in 1981 that still is true today is how do you protect the couple, particularly the caregiver, and what are the ways you protect them? And the conversations are tough. These are very tough decisions for families because you're balancing dollars on one side and the cost of care and commitment on the other side. No one wants to put a family member in a long-term care facility. Imagine that today, the average cost of a nursing home bed is about $110,000 a year. I don't have $110,000 a year, and most Americans don't to do that. But imagine trying to pay for that. But if you can turn that $110,000 a year around and cut it by a third or a fourth, and deliver those services in the home, you're not only helping the individual who's the patient, you're substantially helping that spouse and the family entirely. And it's a family decision that we look at when we talk about long-term care.
Yeah, it's a very difficult one, and one that sometimes involves guilt when you do have to send a loved one to outside of the home to an assisted living facility. You know, many would assume, you touched upon this, many would assume services at long-term care are covered by Medicare, but that's not the case. Are you able to explain why, and does Medicare cover any at-home services?
Medicare covers limited home health services if you had been institutionalized prior to that. So you have to be hospitalized to qualify for Medicare home health services. Other than that, Medicare is silent on these kinds of issues and has been silent for years. The last piece of major Medicare legislation that Congress passed, and I was part of it, was the Medicare hospice benefit. to allow people to die with dignity in their home or in a hospice facility. But they've stayed away from long-term care programs, community-based long-term care services, both because of a lack of understanding, but more importantly, because of costs.
Yeah. As someone, as you just indicated, you previously worked in Congress for three U.S. senators. There's a lot of components to this. We just touched upon Medicare, but what steps do you think we need to take on a legislative side to be best prepared for this population shift?
You know, if you give the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Becerra, from California, so we say it proudly, if you give him the flexibility to allow for community-based programs across the nation to build pilot projects like we're doing in the California Central Valley, to provide some additional funds to what we're doing, you can look at this as a petri dish in multiple communities in different states and design those strategies, because what will work in the Central Valley may not work in San Francisco and may not work in the Palm Desert. And there probably isn't one solution that does work. But the key to this is understanding what the data says and having the right partners in place to do this. One of the things that we've done is build a partnership with for-profit and nonprofit companies. We have CareLinx as a for-profit partner, the largest respite care company in America. Dr. Francesca Rinaldo, who is just absolutely brilliant, and we're lucky to have her on our team. We were using Stanford as a research, part of our research team. Dr. Nareb Shah, another just big brain that is just amazing. Community Care Choices is our nonprofit palliative care provider from Modesto. Community Health Centers of America is our physician practice. It's an FQHC. And then we've got this amazing pharmacy partner, TIN, T-I-N-R-X, out of Turlock, who will deliver all the pharmacy services for people in need. Every community can build these kinds of solutions by following the model that the city of Turlock, the mayor, and the city council have done, if they're committed to caring for people across their community. And that's the real question. Are they committed?
How long will this pilot last?
This pilot will last for 6 to 12 months. It will be open source. So as we are developing everything and building the database, it will be publicized on the Legacy Health Endowment website. To make sure that people have access to it, and utilizing Dr. Nareb Shah and his colleagues at Stanford, we know that their analytical skills will be phenomenal.
I'm curious, given that this pilot is starting, 2.5 years into the pandemic, how has the pandemic impacted caregiving?
In many respects, the pandemic has devastated caregiving because you couldn't get service providers to come into the home. And the service providers who did come into the home should be talked about as heroes because they went well and beyond. But the impact on the caregiver spouse who couldn't find those other services finds her health care today diminished, finds her mental health challenged, and finds her economic future questionable. And the pandemic made that substantially worse.
Exacerbated it. Finally, Jeffrey, the reality is deciding whether or not a loved one should remain at home or be moved to a nursing home can be difficult. It is emotional for a family to make. What advice do you have to caregivers and their loved ones in beginning those tough conversations and ultimately reaching a decision that is best for everyone?
Have a family conversation, regardless of what the family size is and who's in the family. Include the patient as part of that conversation. Be honest with each other about the kinds of services that are needed, the costs involved. Don't be afraid to reach out to people like me. You can make my email available to people and I will assist them happily to help them think through how do we do this. There are no easy solutions for families. I wish I could say that I could send you to one source, but there isn't one source. Many communities have area agencies on aging. The state of California has a robust Department of Aging. You have to look at multiple sources, but never be afraid. you know, the one thing I do is my phone number has been used for multiple years where people call my cell phone because I give it out freely. Call me on the phone. Area code 703-403-9695 or Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y at legacyhealthendowment.org and we'll help you think through these problems.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for the time. And we do have a link to your information on our Insight page. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You too. Jeffrey Lewis is the president and CEO of the Legacy Health Endowment in Turlock, highlighting some of the key findings of their caregiver survey in both Stanislaus and Merced counties and a program they're developing for caregivers to help loved ones at home. Still ahead, for the first time in two decades, the Rodgers and Hammerstein masterpiece Carousel returns to Broadway at Music Circus. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Lights, camera, action. Broadway Sacramento celebrates their 70th anniversary, and after 2 years on hiatus because of the pandemic, they're kicking off summer with Broadway at Music Circus, with shows that include Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel. Leading the charge is producing artistic director Scott Clyer, who's worked with Broadway Sacramento for over two decades and continues to produce musicals for the greater Sacramento region. CAP Radio's very own classical host, Jennifer Reason, joins us to discuss her musical work as a pianist with the production of Carousel and once again performing to a live audience after 2 years. Thanks for joining us, Scott and Jennifer.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, we're going to get a little sample. Let's set the mood with a clip from the Carousel musical playing at Broadway Sacramento. That is literally like turning the lights back on after 2 years in the dark. So the theater lights back on at UC Davis Health Pavilion. How does it feel to be back in front of a live audience, Scott?
Glorious. Glorious. And when you have an orchestra pit filled with 17 musicians making that sound,
yeah.
I mean, there is nothing like witnessing that live.
How has it been over the, you know, more than two decades moving up through Broadway Sacramento?
There are many, many, many stories. It's a pleasure. This is a theater that I grew up in, that my grandparents subscribed to, that my parents subscribed to. So I feel that it is my responsibility to continue that legacy.
And you are doing it so well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I saw your photo on Instagram. It is incredible being surrounded by an audience live at that. How is it feeling? I mean, you guys just opened this week, right?
We did. We opened on Tuesday. And I think surrounded is exactly the key word, because not only is the audience back, it's literally encompassing you. It is theater in the round. So to have people all around you, front, back, sides, kind of just absorbing what you're doing, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. Scott, you know, given that you started your career as an intern, right, at Broadway Sacramento.
This is true.
And you've really had your hand in nearly all aspects of musical production at Broadway Sacramento. What elements of production still excite you?
Well, all of them, actually, you know, especially with the people that we are fortunate to recruit to join us each summer to make things happen. I mean, musically, I mean, the finest musicians in Northern California, and folks come from far and wide to play in this pit. Our talent from all over the country, most from New York. As it happens, our two leads in this show are locally born and raised.
Oh, that's awesome.
Grew up in the same theater and now leading the charge in Carousel.
That is great. And, you know, Broadway Sacramento has touring acts as well. But what's the process and really the considerations with show selection when it comes to Broadway at Music Circus?
We try to find something for everyone. And bring a wide variety of shows that represent the whole canon of musical theater. So starting the season with Kinky Boots, transitioning to Carousel, there's a lot of contrast there.
Indeed. Finishing
the season with The Color Purple. You know, I hope that, you know, the audience feels like they've attended a multi-course gourmet meal at the end of the summer.
All right, well, let's start with Carousel. You know, for those who haven't taken it in, describe it. What's the background of this musical?
Well, Carousel is probably Rodgers and Hammerstein's finest score, and they are really the cornerstone of the musical theater. Starting with Oklahoma, Carousel was their second collaboration, both of them huge hits on Broadway. And, you know, I think that the score is really why it continues to be produced today. I don't know that there's a finer one in the musical theater canon.
Well, let's take a quick listen to Soliloquy. Felt that in my bones.
Yes.
Reverberating. Jennifer, you're a very integral piece when it comes to musical scores. For a musical of this magnitude, there are so many pieces, I would imagine. How do you prepare for your performance?
Well, first, it's a lot of listening and a lot of watching. There's been lots of renditions, lots of productions of this show. You try to get your hands on every single one of them. And then you start with the score months in advance, if at all possible.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, my next question. How far in advance do you plan and learn the musical scores?
You know, it's not always with enough time, but luckily Broadway Sacramento is super pro, and I got the score about 3 months ago, so I had plenty of time.
You know, what's miraculous is that the musicians produce that sound with four rehearsals.
Yeah. Wow.
So for Jennifer to admit that she spent months preparing for it. I mean, I think that's the key. That really speaks to their dedication. But they're paid for four rehearsals to make that sound. Mm-hmm. It's quite extraordinary.
That is incredible, especially that it sounds, you know, as cohesive and as powerful as it does. Given that this is a musical sequence that explores stories, but really with no lyrics or spoken lines, right, in Carousel? Or are there spoken, or there's a musical sequence that explored stories' themes? I'm just curious, how are performers effectively speaking to the audience, really through dance and through music?
It really takes all of those mediums to communicate these stories. And that's why they're so rich. I mean, I think that musical theater appeals to all the senses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the visual, certainly the auditory, and then the kinesthetic, all the feels that you get from these stories.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
I was going to say, I think you're right, Vicky, though, that there's a lot of powerful dance scenes that don't have any words, and those almost speak the loudest in their storytelling. So I think you're exactly right about that.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. I'm just curious, you know, you're talking about Kinky Boots and also Carousel. How did you choose the sequence and the order of the shows that are going to be taking place at Broadway at Music Circus?
There are a lot of factors in it. You know, again, variety is our goal. And but there's also a lot of synergy between the companies of each show. None of them stand alone. All of them have folks that track through them. So you try to line up the shows so that a performer that works for Carousel can transition into Kiss Me, Kate, and then can also be in Something Rotten. And so that's what kind of motivated this season.
I would imagine also a musical like Carousel kind of helps us celebrate and connect to our common humanity.
Absolutely. It is a very human story, you know, humanity in all of its forms and flaws. And I think what's really beautiful about it is the emotion that the score and the play itself evoke.
How did you feel after the first performance, Jennifer?
Like crying.
Along with the audience.
Exactly. There's so much sound. There's so much powerful art making from all around. It's just, you just sit there and bask.
Well, let's take in another clip. Wonderful. Scott, I'm going to ask you, how did you feel after the first performance this week?
Elated, you know, as I do with all the shows. I mean, first of all, the fact that they come together in 2 weeks is
astounding.
Every single one of them is nothing short of a miracle. But again, it's talent like Teal Wicks and James Snyder, Sacramento born. We just heard Teal and her incredibly dulcet tones. You know, It's pretty invigorating. And then, you know, to see the audience respond to it, I think is where it all comes full circle.
I mean, I really just want to hit that home. It's really incredible that 2 weeks and what, four rehearsals. How many performers are we talking about?
34 in Carousel.
That is incredible. And given that this musical, Carousel, is considered a timeless masterpiece, even by the Time magazine back in 1999, what do you think makes Carousel really stand the test of time?
I think that it's its richness. You know, I think musically we've stressed that, but also in its storytelling. You know, I think that all of Rodgers and Hammerstein's musicals were groundbreaking in their time, and I think they've stood the test of time, and they have withheld their integrity with all kinds of different interpretations. There was a recent revival of Oklahoma on Broadway that took it in a really strange direction, but it still communicated and appealed to an audience, and I think that is the true test of masterpieces.
How do you think it resonates with audiences?
I think it's going to be a real conversation starter. And if that isn't the point of art, then I don't know what is. We should be talking about it, and we should be having lots of ideas and, you know, relevancy conversations. And also the music that it will never not be stunning and gorgeous and moving. And, you know, Beethoven is like that. Mozart is like that. And here we are today still doing it. So
we're in the catharsis game.
Amen.
You know, and we want to make people feel things. And I think Carousel does that.
Yeah. And I'm sure very successfully. I just really want to hit home that, you know, Carousel and y'all reopening again is really like going from 0 to 60 following 2.5 years of a pandemic and then just continuing to accelerate that pace. How does that feel after such a long hiatus?
You know, that's a good question. I believe that the people that make our shows happen on and off stage are athletes. And I think we've all atrophied a bit. And so we've had to find our sea legs doing this again, working the schedule, you know, creating at this pace. And I think our folks have done an amazing job doing it.
That's a wonderful analogy, Jennifer.
I'm just going to go ahead and say my arms are actually sore.
I can imagine. You've been busier than ever.
Yes. I mean, because I was the rehearsal pianist for the show in addition to being in the pit. So that's double-digit hours of playing at the piano. I'm not in shape for that.
Well, you definitely are stepping up to the plate, that's for sure. Well, thank you both for joining us, Scott and Jennifer. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm just so excited for the both of you.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
And that is Broadway Sacramento producing artistic director Scott Collier and Cap Radio's very own classical host Jennifer Reason. We do have more information on showtimes on our Insight page at capradio.org. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great holiday weekend. We will catch you back after the July 4th week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.